That's why I said yes to this podcast, because okay. It was quite interesting, actually.
Yeah. So when you breathe out through the mouth, yeah. you get rid of 42% more moisture than when you breathe out through the nose. Okay. So when you're trekking around, I noticed you're panting quite a lot, which is a natural thing to do. But if you can train yourself to keep the mouth shut and do nasal breathing, then you'll actually reserve a lot more liquids in your body, like a significant amount.
Right.
The other thing as well is if you can focus on breathing a bit more gently and a bit more smoothly, your lungs will operate more efficiently. And I can't remember how much all the lungs and diaphragm weigh, but they actually do take quite a lot of calories up. And when you're breathing 25,000 times a day and you might be breathing too heavily, you can actually burn a significant amount of calories. I can't remember what the numbers are now. So right. just really, it was those two things around try nasal breathing and try just a smoother, slower breath. And those two things, they might just give you a little bit of an edge now and again in terms of your thirst and your calorie deficit and that sort of thing.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Take a Deep Breath. Today's Breathcast guest is Ed Stafford, British explorer and the only human to ever walk the entire length of the Amazon. Started where the snow's melting in the mountains and it goes all the way through, and he took about 2.5 years to trek through dangerous jungles, eating all sorts of different things and getting to the ocean. Ed is on the Discovery Channel and has a number of different fantastic different TV shows. And I have to say, I've binged everything in anticipation of this interview. And it was just wonderful. Ed's actually from a very close place to where I live. And, you know, just a coincidence, really. But we had a really great chat on Zoom, social distancing. Ed's got a couple of courses out right now as well, so be sure to check the links in the description. He's a real expert of bushcraft. But what's really interesting for me personally, and hopefully you guys find the same way, is this thing about the mind, mindfulness. And imagine things like he spent 60 days on a desert island alone, and he started off naked. He's just got the cameras, no camera crew. And what you go through, I can only guess, mentally, to adapt to being able to find some sort of clothing to wear. How do I get food? How do I get water? How do I handle that amount of loneliness, hunger? And for me, I'm somebody that's always striving for discomfort, because I really do believe comfort is the enemy of success, of happiness. You know, we're put on that jumper because we're a little bit cold. As you know, if you've seen my different exercises in the past and different videos, I love a bit of cold exposure. And I guess speaking to Ed and watching Ed, it really made me think I need to get more uncomfortable. It was a fantastic conversation. I was so happy to speak with Ed. I hope you enjoy this. Just a couple of very quick messages from me before we get stuck into the Breathcast. If you haven't done so already, please like, subscribe and share. It helps grow the community. Hit that like button. It helps the YouTube algorithm. It means that more people get to see the content. We have the Patreon account. So thank you so much, everybody that has helped us out so far. And let us know in the comments how you found this and what other sort of guests you would like to see on the Breathcast. Anyway, as I say always, without further ado, let's get stuck into the Breathcast.
Okay, good afternoon, Ed. Welcome to the Take a Deep Breath podcast. How are you doing today, sir?
I'm really well, mate. Yeah, I'm top of the world. We've got twins who are less than 3 weeks old, and so I'm a little bit rough around the edges. Oh, wow. but I'm happy.
Yeah, congratulations. Okay, so yeah, so twins and 3 weeks, so I guess your sleep is being a bit impacted at the minute.
A little bit. I mean, actually, it's not as bad as we thought it might be. Like, they, because they share the womb together, they're like, if you put them down next to each other, they kind of comfort each other, actually, which is quite cool. You know, fingers crossed, it's not going to be too horrific.
Bad. Yeah, well, I guess you're a man that's used to sleep deprivation, so this is just good training for you.
Nobody likes it, though, do they? I love a good night's sleep. I do. I hate waking up when you're absolutely knackered. But no, mate, it's all good. It's all smiles in this house.
Yeah. Wonderful. So I have been binge watching your shows over the last week, just getting in preparation for today. And me and my girlfriend have become a little bit obsessed with watching what you've been doing. So I'm really excited to get stuck and ask you some questions. My first question, and this kept coming up when we're watching your show, and I just wondered, why are you doing this? Can you just give us some understanding as to why you keep putting yourself in these situations?
I think it's the opposite to going stale, I suppose. I think I do fear life just going by, and like if somebody makes me watch an episode of a soap opera like Coronation Street or Emmerdale or something, I can just feel my life passing by. I can feel every single second being wasted, you know. And I think weirdly these sort of being dropped off in the middle of nowhere and having to come up with solutions of how to find food and how to get shelter and all that sort of stuff. It's like it's just like a really condensed sort of version of life where you're having to think outside the box and you're having to come up with solutions. And it's, I think it just keeps me on my toes. I think it keeps me young. I think it keeps me humble. I think it enables me to keep growing and learning and stuff like that. So I think, you know, and obviously I've got to pay the bills. And if someone's prepared to, you know, pay me money to do daft things like film myself or you know, try and survive in the wilderness, then I'll take that. Because it's, for me, I think that's more interesting than, I think my careers advisor said I was going to be a logistics consultant for Boots.
That's a bit more interesting. Wow. But I'm by no means, I wouldn't even consider myself 1% the adventurer you are, but I've done a couple of bits recently. So I did a Camino in 2017 across Spain. And I prepared physically for that, really physically. I had the big backpack and it was a 500-mile trek in 30 days across the north of Spain. But to what I've heard you say a lot in your shows, it was the mental part that really wore me down. I was about 3 weeks in and it really started to wear on me. I just wanted to give up and managed to somehow push through it. I was exhausted. We were sharing these kind of bed dorms with 50 other people. I don't know why the people that snore first are the ones that always go to sleep first as well. But it was that mental challenge that really was the barrier towards the end. What have you learned about these mental challenges? I know this is a really big question. It can go in so many ways, but can you give us some insight into kind of what's gone on in your head? And is it like a bicep curl? Are you getting stronger with the mental challenges as you go through now? And each time that you get into some sort of situation, does it get a little bit easier or not? I'd just be curious to get your thoughts on some of that.
Yeah, I think it does. I think you can go too far though. I think, you know, if you stretch your comfort zone, then you're taxed to a certain degree. And I'm sure there's all sorts of charts and models if you get sort of professional, you know, motivational speakers will talk about this and sportsmen speak about this a lot. I think if you push too far, then you kind of break. And certainly when I did the 60 days on the island thing, I think it was the straw that broke the camel's back. I went into, you know, I had a bit of a breakdown, went into therapy for a couple of years actually. But I think, you know, it's a bit of a cliche, isn't it? That breakdowns are also sort of breakthroughs in life, and sometimes you need to fall apart in order to sort of become the new version of you. And I do think I've learned loads over the years, and I do think I'm such a different human being than the slightly arrogant ex-army officer who started walking the Amazon. And partly because you're just being humbled time and time again. You don't have all the answers, you don't have all the solutions, and you can't just tell people what to do and expect, you know, clip your fingers and expect it all to happen. It doesn't work like that. And I think I've become more emotionally balanced over the years, and I think therefore, you know, you've just got more experience, and so invariably when you go into each situation now, you still might not have all the answers, but you kind of know that you're going to be okay, because a bit like doing a motivational speech, like if you do number one, you stand up in front of loads of people and talk, you're bricking it because you think you're going to stumble over your words, but then when you've done 50 of them, I know I've got a memory bank of experiences where they've gone well, and therefore I'm not as worried as I was. And I think it's just, you know, becoming older and wiser and uglier, and it all gets a little bit easier.
Okay. And how do you start to prepare yourself? So if you had a mission coming up in a couple of weeks or a couple of months' time, what sort of things are you doing mentally and physically, and especially with food as well? It'd be really interesting to know what are you doing coming up to those events?
Not as much as I think you think I am. To be honest, I mean, take walking the Amazon. I mean, we started, we had double chins, and we just decided, look, it's going to be a miserable couple of years. Let's enjoy the time before we go, you know? Yeah. And so we were drinking quite a lot and eating quite a lot. And figured also, if you're walking for 2.5 years, it's going to take you a couple of weeks maybe to get walk fit with your rucksack on. But after that point, you know, all the training in the world isn't going to have any impact other than what the first 2 weeks of walking would have done anyway. So we kind of figured that that would work. In terms of the episodes, I think the thing that I won't be flippant about that I do have to maintain is mental health. I use a little app called Headspace. I think it's really, for me, it's really important. I've got one of those brains that has a capacity to just run away with all sorts of things. And sometimes they're positive, but sometimes, and it's like planning expeditions and that sort of stuff and extensions on my house that I can't afford and all that sort of malarkey. Or it can be negative and it's apprehensions and fears and worries about bills and that sort of stuff. So if I step back from that and I just need a little bit of space every day, step back, watch it all, you know, because I'm a firm believer that, you know, your thoughts are autonomous, you know, they're far away all the time. And it's only when you engage with them that you make things worse. And when you step back from them and you've got a bit of perspective, then everything nicely calms down. So yeah, that's been quite a big learning over the years. In terms of physical training, yeah, I've got a chin-up bar and some dips bars in the back garden.
Yeah.
I have got a heavy weights rack and stuff, but I haven't used it in years. Just sort of body weight exercise and stuff like that. And I probably go on 3 runs a week, about that sort of thing, only about 8K, something like that. And I think for me, as I'm getting older, I'm eating healthier, in theory. But, you know, last night I was at the pub and had burgers and Guinnesses and blah, blah, blah. So I just think I don't want to be a monk about
this. Yes.
My wife is younger than me by quite a considerable margin, though, so I don't want to die too early.
Yeah.
And therefore, I'm going to be reasonable. Yeah, it's this whole 80-20 rule, you know.
Yes.
Stick to a relatively good diet, clean living, not smoking, not drinking too much, and every now and again have a little bit of a blast, you know.
Yeah, I love the quote, everything in moderation, including moderation. So it's like, 80-20 rule is definitely something I try and stick to. I'm not perfect. I was just interested if you would maybe, had you tried some sort of like long-term fasting or intermittent fasting before you go on these things that your body just...
Yeah, I mean, the thing about food, I have to admit, I have, if I've got an issue with it, issues over anything, it is actually food. I find... I think I've had food restricted too much in my life and it becomes a little bit obsessive. Mm. So unfortunately, although I know so much about diet and exercise and I've read so much and I do believe in sort of intermittent fasting and being metabolically flexible so that you can burn fats as well as carbs and you don't have big carb crashes.
Yeah.
I think if I'd control my diet too much, I'd end up thinking about it too much and I end up obsessing about it too much. So actually, I've learned over the years, you know, if I'm too obsessive, I'll have these sort of falling off the bandwagon moments where I'll just go, do you know what, I've been restricting my calories too much, or I'm restricting my carbs too much, or you know, all great in theory, but it's not good if then you just go and smash fish and chips and whatever is it, you know. So I think I'm a bit more relaxed about it now, trying to eat healthily and trying to eat cleanly, not too much processed stuff, but am I, you know, counting my grams of carbohydrates and calories and stuff like that? No, not anymore. Because I just think, for me, being relaxed about the whole thing, it makes it all a little bit easier. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So what? It's interesting because you could maybe on the surface it seems obviously so extreme what you're doing. It is, you know, the going out there and spending 10 days. But at the same time, talking to you now at home, you know, sounds like a lot of balance there and a lot of, you know, trying to enjoy life. It's not being too extreme in any one particular thing. I wonder, do you think doing the missions and the challenges kind of help you be more balanced in your day to day?
Yeah, I think they do. I think they've been my sort of, don't want to get too grandiose about it, but they've been my kind of vessel in which I've been able to grow. I think, you know, I think all of the challenges that I've kind of gone through and set myself have been, you know, you learn a bit through each experience, don't you? And therefore, it definitely makes life easier, whether that be the meditation, which again, you know, originally came around as therapy, but now I just think it's a healthy thing to do as part of life. Or, I think it's all been this sort of crucible in which, you know, you work out the stuff you're doing wrong and hopefully and keep doing the stuff you're doing right. And I'm not that I try and be quite, I think the balance is something that's creeping in as I get older. I never used to have balance. I used to be all over the place. And certainly when I was walking the Amazon, I was emotionally very erratic. I was either high or low or whatever. But again, when you've got kids, so it's a different chapter of my life now. I've got a 3-year-old and two newborns. And I think, and we've got a 16-year-old, my niece, who lives with us as well. So quite a different variation of stuff. And I suppose you just fall into that role where you've got people who are looking to you for stability and for reassurance and for love and for care and stuff like that. And I think that helps actually, because it's your kind of duty, isn't it? To be that sort of strong figure. So I think that probably helps as well. It's all too easy to become a bit self-indulgent when you're on your own or living on your own in a flat or something like that, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
But when you've got responsibilities, you kind of have to step up, don't you? So yeah, maybe that's part of it.
Okay, yeah, so that home life balance. At what point do you start to get a bit itchy feet where you're like, I've been living in society too long, I need to go out and do something a bit
right
extreme?
Now.
Okay.
right now. I've been at home. The last filming thing I did was December, and
right.
Doesn't look like we're going to be filming again until November, and that is, touch wood, only if, travel and stuff like that allows. It's cliche, but it's been a blessing this summer. I was around for the whole of Laura's pregnancy, and it was quite a hard pregnancy because there were two babies in there, and then so that's been lovely. Loads of time with my little boy, loads of time going on walks and playing in rivers and building dams and all that sort of cool stuff. I'm climbing the walls right now, and we need to earn some money as well. So I have diversified. I've started a new podcast and also I'm launching these online bushcraft courses next week, which for me is quite a big thing. So that was literally just four dads during lockdown all coming together, all out of work, going, how are we actually going to pay the bills? And we've made these little online bushcraft courses to, encourage people to learn the skills that they need to go outside and live more comfortably for extended periods of time outdoors, without tents and all that sort of stuff. So it's all quite fun. And it's quite nice to be challenged actually in life as well as in a survival situation, because when lockdown started, I was kind of like, ace, right, okay, these are the new set of rules, this is the challenge, you've got to stay at home and you've got to blah, 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 and I don't know, but now it's got a bit boring, I'm ready for slightly more normal life to continue.
These courses and this podcast, I'll put them in the description below for people, but do you want to just give me the names of what they are now and we can...
The courses are literally, if the handle to follow on all the social media is @onlinebushcraft, and the website is bushcraft.academy. The podcast called Dangerous Minds, and both of them are, they're not earning me money at the moment, but it's been fun to start new projects like that and to think outside the box. And as with doing a podcast, it's a whole new set of skills, isn't it?
Yes.
To try and think of good questions, but then listen to the response while somebody's talking and not just sound like a robot just asking a list of questions and to actually become a conversation and free flowing and stuff. It's all a different challenge, isn't it? And I think that's really important. I don't expect to inspire people to go out and take their clothes off and survive in the wilderness, but I think it's representative, isn't it, of throwing more challenges at yourself in order to sort of be a more complete version of yourself. I think that's really what I'm getting at with why I do these things. I think that's the important thing. Start to do the same thing every single day and you stagnate, and therefore, just life becomes a bit grey. And I think you've got to keep yourself on your toes. If you're a little bit scared about what's happening today and tomorrow, then that's probably a good thing.
It's that ups and downs. What I've noticed when I'm watching you is, you have these incredible lows, don't you? You can't get the fire going. at that point, and then it starts to rain and you've not eaten for a couple of days and you shelter. I saw the one where your shelter kind of fell in on you in the jungle. But then the high seems to be so incredibly high as well, because then once the fire gets going or you've got some food in your belly, it's just a massive swing. And I think maybe life is meant to be more like that, because we're just in this place where a lot of us are in the middle all the time. It's not great and it's not awful. Whereas this piece where it's kind of the highs and the lows, we kind of are fearful of the lows, I think, sometimes. We don't want to feel uncomfortable. We don't want to get cold. We don't want to get wet. We don't want to get dirty. But then I think if you do that, then the highs seem to be to be so much more. And that's what I've got, I guess, from watching you so much, is that you seem to put yourself in these positions all the time. I guess what I would love to know is, how the hell are you getting through those lows? Because sometimes I just see and I think, oh my God, I would definitely have radioed for support now, especially when you got some, like, you got like something on your foot in one of the jungles, like a, yeah, something was like eating away at you. And I was thinking, I would definitely be getting some help right now. So how, when it's so low, what are you doing to get through it?
I don't think I have as lows as I was having initially. I think that, again, leading on from the last conversation, I think that has got better over the years. Don't get me wrong. I think as far as TV is concerned, having extremes of emotions works really well, because you don't want somebody who's just fine all the time. Yeah, you want somebody who's either really unhappy or really happy, yeah, or really bored or really something. Anyway, you know, I think from an actual, how I dealt with them perspective, I think, you know, I've always believed that nothing is permanent, you know, and even if things are terrible, you know, it's going to change, or, you know, you're going to have a cup of tea and then things will be fine, or you're going to have a good night's sleep and you wake up and just things, energy shifted, things have got better. And I think I've always thought that, and I've always actually been quite prepared to rough it for periods of time. I think, again, psychoanalyze it as you will, but I just think I'm not that bothered about being uncomfortable. I'm not that bothered about periods of hardship, because if I'm working towards something that I believe in, I suppose, so yeah, there's a sort of no magic thing that I do to get through things. But, you know, in terms of tools, yeah, obviously meditation helps you stop having those extreme highs and extreme lows, doesn't it? But that's only something that I've fed into what I do in relatively recent years, I suppose. So take Naked and Marooned, which is, I think, what you're referring to in terms of the elation and the fire and the deep, deep lows. You know, they said they struggled with the footage, because obviously that was all a very, very real experience. And they took the footage back and they tried to make a program out of it. And I was so up and down that they had to group the highs together, change the sequence of it slightly to group the highs together and then group the lows together, because otherwise it would have been too exhausting for the viewer to keep going up and down and up and down and up and down.
Oh God, he's down again.
We're exhausted.
Yeah.
And so they had to kind of play around with it a little bit to make it watchable, so that you weren't constantly 1 minute happy, 1 minute sad. I think things have changed, as I said, over the years, but yeah, it's, I just think, everything that I've done has been building on the last thing, I think. And for example, one of the things that I definitely learned from the island was, I took some advice off Aboriginal Australians, and, you know, if there's anyone to talk to about spending extended periods of time on their own in the wilderness, it's probably Aboriginals. And they taught me this theory of the three brains, basically, which Aboriginals believe. And I probably, if you've done research on me, I've probably bored you with this already. But the concept is, your biggest brain is your gut and your instincts, and that's the one you should live from. And your second biggest brain is your heart and emotions, and it's kind of a filter, but things should originate down there. And then the smallest brain is your logic, your analytical brain, and this is the one that most Westerners live in. And that's why I was going, having extremes of highs and extreme lows, because I was actually sort of believing that I was the logical brain, which is actually a bit of a tool. It's to predict things and it's to remember things, and it's, you know, it's a tool, but you're so much more than your brain. And they said, if you are, the word that they have for the logical brain is nandupuru. And nandupuru, it can also mean a fishing net that's tangled beyond repair, or fucked, basically. And so you know, live in this brain, and you're going to create all sorts of problems for yourself.
Yeah.
Come from a more animalistic sort of instinctual place, and then suddenly things slot into place. And yes, you've got to use your heart. Yes, you've got to use your logic, but they're filters, and everything should originate from down here, and then it gets filtered on the way out by your feelings towards it, or your analysis of the situation. Mm. So, I mean, that's been a huge. Again, there's so many of these lessons that have had a big impact on my life, but yeah, I don't sort of learn them and then forget them. They all, I suppose, build on,
stack on top of each other.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah. I'm wondering what an Ed Stafford who's 60 is like. You know, is he more of a Yoda, where nothing bothers him and he's been through everything? Yeah, do you ever think about kind of what you'll be like if you keep stacking these kind of things for the next sort of 20, 30 years?
Well, I think, I am becoming calmer, and But, you know, I only have to have a, you know, a week without meditating or whatever. And I do find that, you know, the same old Ed is still there, or the same, even the same sort of things that I do that isn't such positive behavior is still creeps back in. I have to keep on top of things like that. And, you know, everyone's got strains and stresses in life. You know, it's all well and good to look at someone's glossy Instagram pictures and think that their life is amazing. But, you know, we all have bills to pay. We all worry about bits and bobs. We all, you know, have families that are a bloody nightmare to keep in order. You know, I don't know anyone who's not got a nightmare of a family always. So I just, yeah, I'd love to think that I was a little bit zen, but then again, I don't want to be more boring. I think equally, I've had a bit of a journey of self-development over the years, but I don't think there's any need to get anywhere that I'm not now. I think more my focus over the next 10 years will be enjoying my family and enjoying what I've got. And rather than it being a sort of battle to be better and better and better, it's more, right, let's just relax and enjoy this a bit more.
Where do you think the ego lives out of those three brains? Does it live in one of the brains, or is it something
else? Right, yeah. Okay. Yeah, no, I 100% think that your ego is, you know, your own, well, it's the sort of the self that doesn't feel connected. It's the disconnected sort of part of self that is created by believing that you are your brain. I think when you step back from it, you become far more connected with other people. You know, this is the one that thinks that it's just, I think because of the fact it was a tool that was partly to predict dangers, it is focused on fear far more than love, for example, or happiness. And I think I think the ego is often feels threatened, doesn't it? And therefore behaves in manners that are defensive or aggressive. And I think, yeah, again, coming from that more instinctual place, very rare that you'd get aggressive, or, you know, it'd have to be a very appropriate circumstances when you're really in danger, I think. So, definitely up there.
And for somebody that's just, you know, an average person that's, you know, working maybe 9 to 5 and you know, busy all the time, how could I, for example, start to listen to more my heart, my gut? What is it, just meditation? Are there other things that I could be doing so that I could get a bit more connected to those areas, do you think?
A really good book that I keep coming back to is called The Power of Now by Eckhart Tolle. I think that's amazing. I think it's very accessible. I think it changed my attitude towards, I was constantly either thinking about the future or thinking about the past and not being present. I think that's been a big one in my life. The app Headspace has been a great one in my life for just giving myself that little bit of ability to step back from everything and let everything naturally calm down. I think those would be two quite good starting points.
Big steps, yeah. And how do you squeeze your meditation in? Is that something you do first thing in the morning, last thing at night? Where's that sit in your routine?
It's during the day, actually, only because we've got two double beds, not pushed together, but we made a pallet bed basically over the course of lockdown out of 43 pallets. And so we're big advocates of co-sleeping. So there's 5 people in the bed. So it's not like there's any sort of calm or peace in the mornings where I could go and meditate. It's part of my working day. I think, you know, part of my job is keeping myself physically fit. So, you know, going on a run will be part of my working day as well. Working out will be part of my working day, but also looking after my brain will be part of my working day. So that when 5 o'clock comes, that I'm available for the family and for the kids and doing all that sort of stuff, I suppose. But yeah, not everyone could do that, but, you know, lunch breaks could be a way of doing that. You know, just, I mean, it's not exactly the most glamorous of things, but I've just gone and literally sat in a cubicle in a toilet and meditated for 10 minutes if I needed to, because sometimes you just need that space, don't you? You need a bit of me time, and just to, because we're so, always so busy in life, aren't we? We're always so hectic and stressed and this, that and the other. And I think, you know, it's one of the biggest causes of diseases, I think, stress. So yeah, managing that's dead important.
Yeah, no, that's good. Because for me, I have a lot of problems with my back. And so I've made stretching my biggest priority in life now. So every morning, it's the first thing I do is I'll stretch for an hour. But I put off the meditation. And I think there's something to that. And when I think it was Guatemala you're in, and you got that blessing from the chap in the jungle. And he said something like, you know, you've got a chaotic mind and something else. And I thought that really resonated with me. I thought, oh, because I thought he was going to say, oh, you're amazing. Everything's fantastic. You can have a great job. And I thought, how much value is this guy going to really give? And the fact that he gave you something quite critical, I thought, I kind of really connected with that. I thought, oh, my brain feels really chaotic. So do you feel like things have changed since that particular point for you? Has the meditation kicked in after that?
I mean, I think I remember before that feeling like I knew in theory that I should be being present, but it's all well and good to know these things in theory, isn't it? And you go, well, I just then get lost in my thoughts, and you know, then I'm thinking about the future and thinking about that, and I think, you know, it's the nature of mind, isn't it? You are always going to have these autonomous thoughts. It's you're only ever leaning towards a place of being present all the time, and you're never going to actually achieve it, I don't think, personally, unless you are sort of monastic about this whole thing, which I don't think fits in with everyday life nowadays. You know, I think it might not be completely zen, but I enjoy having a beer. I like you know, taking the piss out of people, or I don't think you have to be squeaky clean in life to still benefit from trying to get towards a place of being present or as much as possible, really. But I think all of these things are great if they help, but they're not great if they handcuff you. And it's a bit like being on a diet stopping you from going out and eating with your mates or something like that. It's like, it's the tail wagging the dog, really, shouldn't it? It's like, nothing should stand in the way of you living the most full life possible, but if it enhances your life, then that's good, I suppose.
Yeah, and don't be too critical if you don't squeeze the meditation in one day or something like that, I guess, isn't it? It's not being too harsh on yourself, yeah.
Yeah, and be honest with you, at the moment, it's probably 3 days a week, but you know, just trickle feeding that sort of, the attitude towards that, and you know, again, that the book, The Power of Now, I have that on audio book and have it in the car if I'm on long journeys or something like that, and I think it's just whatever works for you, really, I think, as well. But yeah, I mean, life's difficult, isn't it? I think there's not many people that find life an absolute doddle. And I think it's increasingly difficult with social media and smartphones and all that sort of stuff. So I think, you know, we did an experiment where we took my little boy and my wife on a desert island for 3 weeks. I mean, the difference in the quality of our relationship was extraordinary without all the worries and the nonsense of Western life and the nappies and the this and the other. It was beautiful in many ways. It was hard, actually, but it was beautiful because little boy just completely detached from screens and stuff like that was a far more healthy, far more happy person. So
I loved that episode or show, and I was so impressed with the little boy as well, the way he was just eating little grubs and, you know, playing in the sand and just being, you could just see the presence of him versus, you know, children around that age, which, you're right, can be drawn to screens because that's the easiest thing, isn't it, a lot of the time.
But the thing is, that same human being, when he comes home, will have a strop because he's not got the right flavor ice cream. You know, he's human, but I thought what was interesting is when all those nonsense choices that we have out of absolute luxury are taken away, and you do eat hermit crab or nothing, then he'll eat hermit crab and, you know, he'll enjoy it as well. So I think a lot of that was realizing that we have it all very easy in our life.
At what point does your brain get to, so if you put yourself in a remote place and you're hungry, at what point do you think somebody like me would be like, right, I'm going to eat that bloody crab right now, or worm? I saw you pulling these like worms out the wood and they're full of sand, and I was like, oh. But I think, how many days would it be before I was like, that looks like a delicious bloody treat to me, I'm going to devour that? Is it two, three days?
It happens almost immediately, because again, slight hang up about food. I worry about not having calories in me. So, you know, from the word go on a competition or a challenge like that, it would be, you just got to eat it. And normally it's everything that's pre-fire gets eaten raw because, you know, things go off very quickly and you can't chuck it in the fridge or whatever, can you? So, yeah, I know I'm not, I don't really worry about things like that. I think sometimes you almost have to put on a bit of a show when you eat those weird things because you know that that's what the viewer's going to get a kick out of. But in actual fact, usually you're so hungry that you just love it. It's not a disgusting thing at all. But you can't just, sometimes there's a bit of, you know, you got to ham things up because it's telly and it would be boring not to, but actually, you know, 9 times out of 10, everything I put in my mouth is I'm just bloody grateful for.
Yeah. What's the worst thing you've eaten?
I think tadpoles are pretty minging, actually. If you think about a tadpole, it's just essentially a little sack full of intestines, which are full of shit, aren't they? That made me gag quite a lot. I managed to cut through the gland at the back of a skunk when I was skinning a skunk, and that contaminated all the meat yellow goo, which was minging. And stayed on my hands for days afterwards as well. Couldn't get the smell off because skunk or tadpoles, probably the worst.
They're the ones to avoid. So it shouldn't be called Eat the Frog. It should be called Eat the Tadpoles or Eat the Skunk Gland. You know, that book about the worst things in the jungle. So question for you then, what is it like being with and without the camera? So my guess what I'm trying to ask is, I know that if I've got a camera and I've got, it's almost like I've got someone to talk to and I don't feel as lonely if I've got a camera and I'm walking around with it. Have you been anywhere recently where you've not had a camera and you've had to do something like that, a period of time alone?
I certainly get what you're talking about in terms of sometimes I remember having real lows, getting the camera out as soon as I flip the screen out. I'm kind of consoled by the comfort of the company of the camera, which is ridiculous, isn't it? Because it's still just me. But then my mood lifted and then I found that annoying because I was meant to convey that I was in a bad mood. And then suddenly I've got the camera out and I'm fine again now because I'm having a little natter to the camera. It's a double-edged sword. I mean, it's a pain in the ass because you've got to document everything and you've got to pour your brain out. And I think certainly I used to be, I think partly because there's no point. I was told very, very quickly when in terms of the 4 hours of training I had to film walking the Amazon. But if you just say I'm fine all the time, like I would have done, like if somebody had asked me in the army when I was on a march across a hill or something, how do you feel, Mr. Stafford? I'm fine. Yeah, fine, fine. Bloody boring. So you have to go, well, how do I actually feel? And so then you're going into these emotions. And so actually, I think the filming has made me more self-aware of my emotions and stuff, but not necessarily to my own. I don't know. It does make things harder because all your emotions are being brought up. The moment you vocalize that you're really sad, then you're kind of admitting that you're really sad. Yeah. I don't know. It's probably a good thing, isn't it? Because it's never good to repress emotions. But I don't know. It makes everything 50% harder as well because you're constantly thinking, all right, how am I going to film this? Where am I going to put the cameras? You know, is it going to be interesting enough, quite frankly, as well? And especially on long walks, I did enjoy when drones suddenly became small enough to go into my rucksack and suddenly you're not having to walk back 100 meters to pick up a camera because you can just have a little fucking drone following you and suddenly you can film yourself a lot better. Double-edged sword. But I enjoy the creative challenge of the filming as well. I think it's nice to have something to do other than just surviving. It's nice to think, right, how am I going to tell this story? And being a storyteller is quite a fun thing, I think.
I have to say, you're very good at it. Like we don't binge watch stuff very often, and for the last 6 or 7 nights we're just watching your shows and should we watch one more before bed? And I think you've done fantastic with your shots and whatnot. Do you find yourself talking to yourself when the cameras aren't on as well? Do you find yourself, or is it very much the camera goes on and you get into that mode?
I don't verbalize it. I do talk to myself, but it's not out loud.
Okay.
I think that sort of trick kind of works when the camera's rolling because there's no point having if you are on your own, there's no point having a thought and keeping it to yourself, is there? It's like, Yeah, no, not so much out loud. Maybe every now and again, but I think that is more of a sort of a sort of voice in your head voice that I'm aware that is a bit weird that I'm constantly talking to myself and chastising myself and stuff like that. But otherwise, how do fucking people know what I'm thinking?
What's it look like in terms of meditation and stuff when you're on these missions and these programs? Are you doing it, or do you not need to because you're surrounded by nature?
No, I'd probably need to more, I think, because the pressures are on. And again, it's not just surviving. It's not just the finding food. It's the, you know, is this show going to work, you know? And especially back in the day when I was doing all of my filming myself, the pressure was on to produce all the materials that you needed and not forget shots or you can't just turn the camera on and hope to cover stuff. You've got to plan it normally and mm-hmm. work out where you're going to put a lock off shot or, you know, all that sort of stuff.
Yeah.
So you put pressure on yourself to perform, I think, as well. And then it's only after the first few days when, I don't know, I've got a fire going, or I know I've got quite a few initial scenes in the bag, that I actually sort of relax into actually enjoying them. For the first few days, it's quite hectic normally.
Yeah. Okay, that's interesting. What's on your bucket list for the future then? Can you give me some examples of some things you'd love to do at some points in your life?
Yeah, I think, well, in 2016, I was trying to walk across Antarctica. I was trying to get an expedition off the ground to do that coast to coast via the South Pole. It's been done now. It was at the time. It would have been a Guinness World Record, and I had my eyes on that. I'd love to go to Antarctica at some point. We couldn't get the funding for the expedition to get it off the ground at the time. It's always going to be countered now with having dependents, I suppose, with having kids, and you know, I can't take the same risks that I did when I was walking the Amazon because it would, one, I wouldn't want to, you know, back then I could afford to be reckless with my life because it didn't matter. Whereas I don't think I can now. I think that would be being a bad father. Equally, I think the flip side to that is if you take all risk out of your life, then you become boring. And so I think it's just managing that, making sure we're taking enough risk that as a family, we're all still growing and getting the most out of life and living a full life and not being too sheltered. But obviously keeping everyone safe at the same time.
And for somebody, yeah, again, going back to, I always like to link these things back to like an average person. What are the key things that you think people just need to start doing in their lives? So I know we've talked about meditation, but I guess I'm more angling towards the survival stuff. So should it be that, you know, I should be going barefoot in the forest? Should I be sleeping out in the stars once a year? Can you give some ideas of what you think people should be doing a bit more of to get back in touch with nature?
Well, I mean, that was one of the reasons that we did this online bushcraft course, is that I was talking about earlier. It's like, it's all well and good, isn't it, going, oh, I want to go outside, and you go on a dog walk and you go, right, I've gone on 12 dog walks this week, I need to do something else. But in order to stay outside, you need certain skills, don't you? So for example, one of the courses on knife skills, so properly how to sharpen a knife, how to make a knife, even in the woods, you know, how to use an axe, how to fell a tree, you know, how to build a shelter, how to make a fire with two sticks, all that sort of stuff. I think suddenly once you build up those sort of skills, then there's a whole world that becomes open to you. To walk into a wood and be able to pick up two sticks, rub them together, make a fire is liberating, because you know that if you forget your lighter, you'll be okay. And suddenly your confidence grows and you become more competent in that environment. And I think we all recognize that we spend far too much time indoors, especially post COVID. And, you know, that desire to reconnect at a sort of spiritual, sounds a bit over the top, but, you know, at a sort of soul level, with nature, it's a nice reset. And I think the skills that you learn enable you to be there longer and be there more comfortably, I suppose. So for me, it's just building up that skill set, really, so that you can spend longer outdoors. And, you know, you only ever learn these things once, I suppose. Like, I learned my navigation and that sort of stuff in the scouts. I'm really grateful for, you know, being put through that as a sort of organization. And I think, you know, I've got great memories from that. I think it's building up the skills to allow you to spend more time outdoors, basically.
Yeah. So, because I think, like, take myself as a classic example. I know very little. I often, when I'm watching your shows, thinking, yeah, I'd be dead within the first couple of days, or you know, I'd be a right miserable mess. And so it's.
But I don't think you would. I mean, no. I counter that because, like, I definitely was not a survival expert when I got dropped off on that desert island for the first time for 60 days. You know, I'd gone on expeditions, of course. Could I sleep in a hammock? Yes. Could I light a fire with a lighter? Yes. But was I a bushcraft expert? No, definitely not. And I think maybe that's why the programs were more successful, because I was almost like the viewer, making it up as I went along and just trying to cobble through it and make it all work. Yeah. So I don't think you do need to have all the knowledge. And I think your approach to it all, and just being relatively practical and just going, well, look, I don't have that, but if I do that to this, then, you know, thinking outside the box, trying to come up with solutions, I've spent time as a landscape gardener. I've spent time as a builder and building labourer. I've done other jobs, and you do end up like bringing skills from different things in order to cobble things together and make it work. So, and yeah, obviously the time in the army was a benefit from loads of different reasons. But I don't think not having the skills should put you off. That said, I'm not advocating that people go and do really risky things that's outside their capabilities. I think you do need to learn stuff. But I think, you know, there's loads of good institutions in this country. There's a place called Plasy Brenin in Wales, which is a sort of mountain leader school, which is amazing in terms of equipping you with some of those skills. You can go on a navigation course, you can go on a ropes course, you can learn to climb, you can learn to paddle, you can do all these things and get certifications for it. So there's really safe ways of going up through the system, I suppose. Yeah. And that's a nice way to do it safely. Yeah.
I just think you're a good man to call in the middle of a pandemic or an apocalypse. I think, you know, get everyone head around Ed's house. I think it would be, once the supermarkets go empty, a lot of us are in a lot of trouble, not knowing which routes to eat and all that sort of stuff. I was in Borneo last year, and I nearly got the chance to go with the Penan people. But I chickened out last minute, I think. It was going into the jungle, and it wasn't too expensive, but I'm super terrified of the creepy crawlers. I'd love to know, what's your experience with that in terms of, do you find that they just leave you alone if you clear that space, or I mean, to you, the food, I suppose, a lot of the time as well, but they terrify me.
When I don't think there's as many as people think, you know, there's not a snake behind every tree. Rainforest is, quite frankly, just a wood. It might be a bit damper, there might be a more abundance of wildlife, but it's not as bad as everyone thinks. Most things keep themselves to themselves, you know, certainly the bigger things, like we never saw a jaguar in the entire time we walked the Amazon, like, and that was 2.5 years of walking through a forest which is full of jaguars. So, I mean, I think chances are you're not going to see it. And people are scared of what they don't know, aren't they? You know, and the jungle is one of those things that most people don't have experience of, and therefore they're scared of. But I think it's one of the easiest places to operate in, actually. You just need a pair of wellies and a knife or a machete, and you're away, really. And you don't need ropes or skills of anything, any sort of massive description, really, I don't think. And the stepping off places that you can get into the jungle quite safely. Certainly if you go to places like Iquitos in Peru, they've got loads of guiding schools and experiences. But yeah, Borneo as well. I've spent less time in Borneo, but I don't know. I mean, it's all part and parcel of the excitement, isn't it? I mean, if you're absolutely terrified of creepy crawlies, then don't go to the jungle, I suppose.
I did a night in a place called Bako National Park, which was on the left of Borneo, and I remember thinking, wow, nothing came into our bedroom at night. It was completely sterile. You know, we went for a night walk and we saw tarantulas and all these different things, but going back into the bedroom, it was completely fine. So that made me think they probably don't want to be near us, these sort of bugs and stuff, anyway. They probably sense that there's some danger there, and I think a lot of movies make us think things are a lot worse than they are. So
yeah, piranhas don't strip you to the bone.
No, damn it. What is your stomach like with all this sort of stuff going in? And the reason I ask that is, when I travel, when I go to different continents, there's an adjustment period where those different microbes get in, and you can get a bit unwell for a few days. And I see you drinking out of streams and eating bugs and stuff. Do you have a lot of problems in that world, or do you find that your stomach's quite strong?
I did. It seems to have toughened up. I think the first season of Marooned, I was on antibiotics after every single episode for one thing or another, from drinking dodgy water normally. Seems to have toughened up. I don't know whether it's... I've just been luckier or whether that is the case, whether I've got built up some sort of tolerance. But I think the biggest noticeable difference in terms of the way I react to stuff is mosquito bites. Like for the first three months of walking the Amazon... Like a typical tourist, I was just covered in really raised, inflamed, horrible mosquito bites. And then one day it just stopped and literally had no bites on me. And it's like the indigenous guys that you see, obviously, you never see them getting covered in bites, do you? And I think there was, the body just went, there is no point in, after a certain time, there's no point in coming up with these bites because he's not going to take himself out of this environment. We'll give up now. But that's quite interesting because so still to this day, if I get bitten by mosquitoes, I don't come up in bites anymore, which is quite nice.
Yeah, oh, that's fantastic. So yeah, the body fascinates me, the way it adjusts to different things. So I wanted to give you a little bit of breathing advice that I've seen when I've been watching your show, because part of this podcast is all about breath work. I'm a qualified breath work instructor. And by the way, I am very much aware that I'm trying to give Ed Stafford some advice about something to do with survival. So please tell me to go do one, but I'll just share it anyway.
I'm all ears. That's why I said yes to this podcast, because okay. It was quite interesting.
So when you breathe out through the mouth, you get rid of 42% more moisture than when you breathe out through the nose. Okay. So when you're trekking around, I noticed you're panting quite a lot, which is a natural thing to do. But if you can train yourself to keep the mouth shut and do nasal breathing, then you'll actually reserve a lot more liquids in your body, like a significant amount.
Right.
The other thing as well is if you can focus on breathing a bit more gently and a bit more smoothly, your lungs will operate more efficiently. And I can't remember how much all the lungs and diaphragm weigh, but they actually do take quite a lot of calories up. And when you're breathing 25,000 times a day and you might be breathing too heavily, you can actually burn a significant amount of calories. I can't remember what the numbers are now. So just really, it was those two things around try nasal breathing and try just a smoother, slower breath. And those two things, they might just give you a little bit of an edge now and again in terms of your thirst and your calorie deficit and that sort of thing.
Do you sort of advocate the, I can't remember whether it's sort of water, whiskey, all that sort of different breath, the sort of yogic breathing that can take you sort of out of, I can't remember which one's the parasympathetic and the sympathetic nervous system, but it can change you from sort of fight and flight mode to sort of oxytocin mode. Do you advocate that sort of breathing as well?
I do. So if you the nose again is a great thing for the parasympathetic, which is the rest and digest. Right. So if you can be breathing nice and slowly, especially if you're feeling really down or quite panicked, if you can just focus on, you know, slow box breathing. I know they do that in the military quite a lot, which is an in, a hold, an out, and a hold. If you can just slow your respiratory system down, your brain kind of slows down and you can relax and you can think a bit clearer about things. So that's another thing that's worth trying if you're in a panicked situation. But honestly, I thought, oh, I need to tell Ed about this. He might tell me to bugger off. But I was thinking, oh, if he can keep his mouth shut, he'll actually need less water. It might get him going a bit further. So there you go. That's my bit of advice. I'd be interested to see how you get on with that. I'm conscious we're coming to the end, Ed. So last couple of very quick questions.
Okay.
What one bit of advice would you tell somebody if they got stuck somewhere up a mountain, in a forest, they got lost? What one bit of survival advice would you give them?
Sit down. I think the one sort of classic thing that people do is they panic and they get themselves into more trouble than they would do if they just sat down and composed themselves. So in the military, we used to have an acronym, which was STOP, but stop, think, organize, plan. And it was literally the first thing, or the most important thing to do was just sit down and appraise your situation. And actually the most likely place you are to be found is where you were originally. So the worst thing you could do is just start running around because you think you should be going that way and you get yourself further lost and into further problems. And it's all about building up your knowledge of the area. So I would then, in a controlled manner, for example, if I stopped and I was in a jungle situation, I'd clear all the vegetation around me just so I can see where I physically am.
Right.
I might walk 50 meters in one direction. And if I find something, I write it down and note it, like water or a stream or something like that. But then I'd come back and I'd very progressively, I'd just work my way out from the center, but I would always come back. And that way I'm building up my knowledge of the area slowly and surely. Like, I know there's firewood out to the east. I know there's, you know, or I might find the group, obviously. So it can help with self-rescue as well, but not complicating it. Always just going out in one direction, coming back to the middle, going out another, and then increasing distances. That's a very basic strategy for what to do when you're lost.
Fantastic. Thank you for sharing that. And what is your favourite survival movie? It doesn't have to be a realistic one, but do you have a favourite movie that you enjoy?
Where somebody's got, I don't know whether it's a survival movie, but Revenant is pretty amazing, isn't it? The Leonardo DiCaprio one. Yeah. Extraordinary. I mean, unrealistic if you're in many respects in terms of him getting that fire going in the rain and the wet and all of that sort of stuff. But yeah, that's pretty fucking cool. Yeah,
good film. Yeah, good old Leo. So where can people find you again, Ed? Just give us a couple of ideas where they can go and look for you online.
Well, Instagram's Ed_Stafford, and everything's linked from that, actually. I've got one of those link tree things, so they can get the online courses or the podcast or the website or everything from that. So yeah, that's the place to find me.
Instagram. Wonderful. Guys, make sure you check Ed out. It's been a fantastic, fantastic conversation. I've been so grateful that you've spent this time, Ed. And please, guys, check out the links below and leave us some comments and descriptions and let us know how you found this podcast, and maybe share any of your experiences that you've had when you've been doing something in the wild or some sort of adventure. Ed, thank you so much for your time. And
thank you.
See you on the next one. Cheers.
Thank you.